So we had about a 25, 30 minute break. I just want to make sure that we didn't lose anybody to the hopelessness that we laid out. You know, I remember when I was new still sometimes you hear this, you go to an open discussion meeting at a clubhouse and you hear these conversations about, wow, you know, I just did step one and I'm so excited. And I think, my God, what book are you reading? What step one did you just take? There's no good news in step one, right? Step one basically is, I'm screwed. Step one is that I can't stop. There's nothing I can do that'll let me stop. When I stop, when I put it down, I'm driven by my emotions and my mind and the things that go on inside of me, and I can't stay stopped. Which would be fine if only I could have a couple of beers. Right? I mean, if I could, was like some people that I know where they have a tough day at work and they say, oh my God, I need a drink. All right? And they go have a drink, or maybe two, three at the most. And then they breathe out and they exhale and they're fine. But I'm in a trap. There's nothing I can do. I can't drink, I can't not drink. I'm completely screwed. And I'm screwed to a point where either when I'm drinking, I push my life and I push myself into a place where through my drinking, my actions are so embarrassing, cause me so many problems that I want to die. Or I stay in a state of abstinence where I don't drink, and a state of abstinence drives me to a place where I'm so uncomfortable in a state of abstinence that that I drink again. And we're going to take a look. We're going to start on page 44, and it says that, in fact, at the beginning of We Agnostics, it says, in the preceding chapter, you've learned something of alcoholism. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably an alcoholic. Now, I got to be honest with you, for years and years and years, I read that wrong. And then when I finally read it correctly, I just thought Bill said it wrong. Because you would think that it would say, if when drinking you have very little control over your, no control over your take, and when you want to quit entirely, you can't. Because for me, my estimation of alcoholism is what Bob talked about and what I talked about a little bit, which is this idea that I have to have both things wrong with me for me to be an alcoholic. And I believe that. I believe that for me to have alcoholism, I have to have both things wrong with me. So why would Bill, when he writes this, why would Wilson write this in a way where it seems like if you have one or the other, you might be an alcoholic? And I think the reason is simply this. That in my life, when I've come to a place that I might come to Alcoholics Anonymous, when I'm beaten into a place where AA looks like a good alternative to me, it's not both things that are going on in my life at the same time. What happens to me is that I have been beaten up by my drinking so bad. I got another DUI. I lost another job. She left again. I spent all my money one more time. My drinking has caused me so many problems that I've come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is clear and apparent to me. Or, I've quit. I've quit and I've been quit for a while. And there are many people that come to Alcoholics Anonymous that have quit and they've been quit for a while. And they get here and their lives are unmanageable and they're always upset and they're depressed and they're a nightmare and their lives seem to be on them and their emotions are on them and they're depressed. And they show up in Alcoholics Anonymous having not drank for a while. And abstinence is making him crazy. And so I think that Wilson was very insightful when he wrote that paragraph, because he was talking to each of us in the place that we are when we get here. There are times in my life that I got to Alcoholics Anonymous because I couldn't quit drinking. There are times in my life that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because I couldn't stay quit from drinking. I never showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous with full knowledge of both pieces of that. I had to be taught that by the members of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was here. So I believe that when Bill says that ask the questions if it's one or the other, I think that that's because of the way that I show up here. But I show up here. I show up here a disaster. I told you before that I was coming to Alcoholics Anonymous for about 3 years before I was able to stay sober. And I would get about 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 days sober. And then I'd get drunk. And then I'd get 2 days sober. And then I'd get drunk. And then I'd get 60 days sober and I'd get drunk. I got 30 days sober a couple of times. I lied about 60 days sober one time. Right? But I would sometimes get drunk the same day I showed up. But on average, if you took a look over the 3 years, on average, you can figure that probably what I did on average typically was stayed sober about 10 days. And if I stayed sober about 10 days, and I did that for 3 years, or 365 days in a year, that's 36 and a half times I got drunk every year. Times that by 3 years, it's about 100. About 100 times I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous, said that I was an alcoholic, and drank again. I didn't want to drink again all those times. I wanted to be sober. What was the problem? Why is it that I drank again time and time again? And on page 45 it says lack of power. Lack of power. That was our dilemma. I didn't have the power to stop drinking as much as I wanted to. And there were some times in AA in the early days when I was showing up that maybe I didn't really want to. But in the last year or so of coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't want to live like that anymore. I didn't want to continue to be that way. I didn't know a way not to be. I'd be sober, I'd be abstinent for a short amount of time, and life would just seem like the very best it was going to be was boring. Right? And that was going to be a good day. Right? You would say things that made me crazy. I'd come to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and you would say to me, you say, Sheldon, you know, you don't have to worry about staying sober for the rest of your life. Because the rest of my life just looks bleak for me to stay sober for the rest of my life. I don't want to stay sober for the rest of my life. You don't have to. You don't have to stay sober for the rest of your life. You can stay sober one day at a time. Which isn't good news when you're new. Right? I mean, one day at a time is good news when you've been sober for a while, you got a sponsor, you're actively involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're working the steps, you're doing all this great stuff, you're in the middle of your home group, and something bad happens. And one of your buddies says, don't worry about it, Sheldon, this too will pass. We're not going to do this forever. Right? Let's just get through this together one day at a time. Yay! One day at a time. But when I was new, and I had been sober for 7 or 8 or 9 days, and I have no way to really know what it feels like to be sober a bunch of time in Alcoholics Anonymous in the middle of the program with a sponsor. The only place I can connect with is 8 days sober, and I think I'm going to stay sober for the rest of my life feeling 8 days sober. When you say that you're, you know, my name's Sheldon, I'm sober 18 years, I think you poor bastard. Right? For God's sakes, 18, could you imagine he's been feeling 8 days sober for 18 years? Oh my God. Right? I mean, just one day at a time sounds like one day at a time, right? You stay sober one day at a time, one long, miserable day at a time, right? 24 painful hours, one after another, after another. And you say that to someone, you say, oh my God, I don't think I can handle what it would feel like to be sober one day at a time. And they say to you with a straight face, right? Like they're not kidding. They say, they should be, they say, you don't have to stay sober one day at a time. You can do it. 1 hour, 60 painful minutes. We hear the goddamn second hand tick, tick, tick. It's no wonder I drink again. Because I think that that's what it's going to be like for me to be sober for however long you think I'm going to suffer this agony, right? One day at a time. So I drink again, and I get sober, and I drink again, and I get sober, and I drink again, and I, what do you mean by I don't have the power to stay sober? And eventually they pointed out to me, You know, and I get asked stupid questions like, have you ever had a relapse? But by this time, they've seen me in the club. They know I've had it. I've told them my story. I've told them that every 10 days, about 36 and a half times, probably about 100 times in the last 3 years. And then they say, well, have you ever had a relapse? Well, of course I've had a relapse. Are you listening for crying out loud? And they say, well, do any of your relapses have anything in common with each other? Well, I don't know. Well, last time you drank, Sheldon, last time you've been sober for 7 or 8 or 9 days, why did you drink? What happened? Why did you drink? Well, I drank because I got in a fight with my boss. Well, makes sense. It's a good reason to drink. It's good. Did you get in a fight with your boss every single time you had a relapse? Well, no. I mean, sometimes. If I got in a fight with my boss, I drank. But every time you had a relapse, did you have a fight with your boss? Well, no. Well, what about the time before that? Why did you drink the time before that? I got rejected by a woman. Well, did you drink it? Every time you had a relapse, was it because you got rejected by a woman? Well, I don't know. No. Well, is there anything that every single one of your relapses had in common? Every relapse you ever had, is there anything that every relapse you had in common? Oh, I guess not, no. But I said, well, yeah, one thing. Every time you made the decision to drink, you were as physically sober as you are right now. Every time you'd been sober for a day, a week, a month, 2 months, every time you made the decision that today would be a good day for you to start to drink again and put your life back on the track that it was at before you got sober, you were as physically sober as you are today. Drinking's not the problem. It's in a state of abstinence. You don't have the power to stay abstinent. You have to find a power by which you can live comfortably in a state of abstinence if you're going to get to be able to be happy or even stay sober and be miserable. You're going to have to. Lack of power is our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live. And it had to be a power greater than ourselves. Well, obviously. Not obviously when I first started trying to get sober, but by the time I had wore everything else out, I'd gotten the new jobs, I'd moved to the new towns, I'd gotten in trouble, I'd gotten out of trouble, I'd begged my parents, I'd gone to detox, I'd lived in a halfway house. I mean, by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and was willing to do this work, I had tried every version of trying, of not drinking that I could come up with. My dad one time sent me to a therapist. I went to a therapist there. And at the time, I wasn't drinking as much as I had at other times. I was smoking a lot of pot, and the therapist told me that the problem was that Mary Jane was my girlfriend and I was afraid of rejection. And obviously I didn't stay sober on that. I tried everything. I had to find some kind of a power that was greater than myself. Obviously. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I want to quit drinking. And I find some hope here. I'm right out of the book where it says that we come to Alcoholics Anonymous and the people in AA start to talk about our fellowship. And they start to talk about the barbecues that we can go to, and they start to talk about the dances we can go to, and they start to talk about all the things that a guy like me can do in Alcoholics Anonymous that are social and wonderful events, and I get excited. And you start to talk about how you drank, and I start to relate to how you drank, and you drank like I drank, and I start to feel like I could fit and I belong here. And you start to talk about how you got in all kinds of trouble, and you start to talk about all the things that happened to you from drinking, the self-loathing and the uncomfortability. And I can see that you don't feel that way anymore. I can see that when you're describing how you used to live and what used to happen to you and how you used to feel, I believe you, because it has a quality about it, a depth and a weight, if you like, where I can tell that you have felt the way that I felt. And you start to describe the fellowship, and you start to talk about the friendships you've made here and the connections you've made here and the joy and the laughter. And you talk about conferences, and you talk about the barbecues, and you talk about the events. And I start to think, man, this could be a place for me. And then you say that you got sober because of God. And Many times we talk to a new man and watch his hope rise as we discuss his alcoholic problems and explain our fellowship. But his face falls when we speak of spiritual matters, especially when we mention God. For we have reopened a subject which our man thought he had neatly evaded or entirely ignored. We know how he feels. We've shed his honest doubt and prejudice. I was born into a Jewish home. I think I mentioned that. I was born into a Jewish home in... Well, that's not really true. We were atheist Jews. Now, what that means is that we were Jews, but we know we were wrong. The only people on the planet that we thought were more wrong were our crazy Christian neighbors. My mom would say things to me like, we'd be getting ready to go out the house, and she'd say to me, you know, religion is the opiate of the masses. It's for fools and children. Now get dressed, we're going to temple. We were ritual Jews. We would do all the rituals. We'd do the holidays. We'd do all the crazy. I don't know if maybe you can relate to this, maybe not, but in the Jewish faith, for example, you can't drive your car on the Shabbos. You can't drive your car on Saturday. It's against the rules to drive your car on Saturday. We were Hasid Jews. My family were religious Jews, and you can't drive on a Saturday, and Shul's temple's on a Saturday, and you got to get to temple. So people that aren't, the Shul was 7 miles from my house, and people would walk 7 miles to get to temple. They were real Jews. They were 7 mile Jews. We would drive and park 2 blocks away. Because we're 2 block Jews. I'm a 2 block Jew. But I've tried the Jewish religion and I don't like it. It doesn't make any sense to me. Maybe because there was a Reverend Kamisa, there was a choir director, a chazan that was in my middle school that was messing with some of the kids sexually, and I don't know if I was mad at him for that or resentful because he didn't mess with me. I'm not sure exactly how that, yeah, what's wrong with me, right? But you know, and so I had prejudice against those people, prejudice against that religion. I couldn't, and I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and you guys start talking about God and I'm like, I can't do a Christian faith. When you grow up in a Jewish home, it would be as crazy as if you were getting sober in perhaps a Muslim country or a Hindu country, and maybe you grew up in a Christian home and your DNA is wired to be in a Christian faith, and the people in the room are saying God as you understand him, but you know they mean a Muslim or perhaps a Hindu God, and it's uncomfortable for you, and you can't do that. I can't do my faith. I can't do your faith. I'm stuck. And besides, even if I could do anybody's faith, I don't believe in any of that crap anyway. I think it's all nonsense. And I'm going to die. And I know I'm going to die. I almost wish I could buy the religious deal. And I almost wish I could. You see people, they'd knock on my door on a Sunday morning when I was hungover, and they'd want to talk to me about God. And you know what? I would goof on them. Right? I would. I'd invite them in, and we'd talk philosophy for hours, and they were easy to pick on, right? But the truth is that they had something. You could see it in their eyes. I mean, they were lit up, and there was something about them that had me, but I can't do it. I don't want to believe. I can't believe. I don't believe. I'm stuck. I remember one time this guy I worked with, his name was Tom Little. This guy was, he was a member of AA. He was also very devout in his faith, and he gave me a big book and he gave me a Bible and he told me, read one of those and see if you can find yourself in one of them. And I read the book. I liked the book. I never read the Bible. Didn't read the Bible. But he says to me, if you ever find yourself really desperate for God, he gave me what he called the sinner's prayer. turns out there's lots of sinner's prayers. This was his sinner's prayer. He said, if you really believe in God, you read this prayer. And if you really mean it, I mean, really mean it. If you mean it, mean it. Mean it. God will come into your life in wonderful, incredible ways. I took the prayer and I shoved it up in a cupboard in my bathroom. And it didn't take long. Week two, 3 weeks after that, I'm blowing snot bubbles in the shower again because I'm at that stage in my life where if you leave me alone long enough to think about me, I'll just start crying because it's pathetic, right? And I'm suicidal and I'm hopeless and I hate my life. And so I go grab the prayer. And I kneel down in my bathroom with this prayer. Now, if you're following the story and you're picturing this, picture me with clothes on. It's just the better picture. I was naked, but don't do that to yourself. Ow! Right? Well, I'm on my knees, and I got this prayer, and I unfold this prayer, and I start to pray this prayer, and I pray this prayer, and I think I meant the prayer. I think I meant the prayer. I prayed the prayer. Nothing. I mean, nothing. Now, I don't know what I expected. You know, if I expected the Wilson lights to bright, the room to go bright, or if I expected angels or harp music, or I don't know what I expected, but there was nothing. You know? But I'm kind of I like what Johnny Harris says, I like to get downtown now. You know what I mean? I'm just a guy that if I take something, smoke something, drink something, I want to feel something right away. Right? And I don't know what I expected. I thought maybe prayer was like three shots of Jack Daniels, right? I say the prayer and I should get the effect, boom, right away. But that's not but I was never good with creeper weed. Remember creeper weed? Yeah, man. I get a bag of creeper weed. I smoke the whole thing. I'm on my way to the dope man's house to tell him he sold me a bad bag. Right? Next thing you know, I come out of a blackout with Cheetos on my fingers. Right?
Just the Cheetos, Bob.
That's sick. I don't know what I was expecting, but I felt nothing. I think I've done God. When you guys tell me that I got to find God, I think I've done God. I think I've tried God. I think I've prayed God. I don't believe in God. I think God is for fools and children. I think it's hopeless. And I'm not mad at you for it. I'm not like, no, you guys are stupid. I'm a little sad by this point because I think that AA is my only hope. I wish there was a way that I could do that. You know, Bob uses this great phrase, breaking through the God barrier. I wish I could break through the God barrier. I can't break through the God barrier. Our sponsor says, we got to do step two. Said, I can't do step two. Can't do step two. Don't believe in God. Don't believe in God. Can't do step two. Can't believe in God, can't do step two, not doing step two. Can't do step three, won't do step two. Three, how can I do step three? Can't do step two, can't do step two, can't do step three. I don't believe in God, can't turn my will and my life over the care of God. Can't do the steps, it's over. We tried. He told me to ask the people in AA that I love and respect, how come they're so... How come they're sober? There are people in our home group that are sober that I like. Ask them how. Well, I'll go ask them. Well, you know what? It's funny. It's like the party line. It's like something that would be on the back of a business card they'd hand out after meetings. They'll say the same thing. Why are you sober? I'm sober today because of the love and grace of a God that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous that allows me to stay sober one day at a time. Sober today by the grace of a loving God that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank God for AA, and I'd like to thank AA for God. Now, I don't mean to goof on that, because I have to tell you that if you ask me why I'm sober today, I'll tell you I'm sober today, because of a power greater than myself that I found in the Lord's house that allows me to stay sober one day at a time. And when I die, if I get to say anything to the big guy, one of the things I might say is, like, by the way, Pops, that AA thing, great idea. Thanks a bunch. And by the way, for those of you that were here when I got here, thanks for introducing me to God. It's a cool deal. It's one of my favorite parts of my life. So I mean it. I'm not goofing on that. It's a serious deal. But this is what they all said. So I go back to my sponsor and I said, well, they all are sober today because of God. And I don't think that's good news, right? Because I think that he's underlining and reassuring me that what he's telling me is true and that that's why I can't, it's over. And then he points out step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening is the result of these steps. Not a result of these steps, not one of the results of these steps, not a byproduct of these steps, not the booby prize of these steps. Not you'll get all kinds of great things. And by the way, one of them in the bushel might be some kind of a spiritual awakening, but it's the only result of these steps. Sheldon, if the people that you love in Alcoholics Anonymous and respect in AA are sober today by the grace of God, and if they found that grace of God through doing these steps, if they could have found them in step 2, or even in step 3, why would you do step 4? I mean, why would you do step 4? I mean, seriously, if you haven't done step 4, I don't want to burst your bubble, step 4 sucks. We're gonna try tomorrow to talk about it in a way where it won't suck as much as it really sucks, but we're just telling you, I'm telling you right, we're lying. Step 5, humiliating. Step 6 and 7, nobody understands 6 and 7. 8 and 9, incredibly expensive. 10 and 11 are so confusing that half the people in this room have been doing step 11 for years and they think it's step 10. Right? And not in Bethlehem. Not in Bethlehem, but everywhere else in the world. Everywhere else in the world. Newcomers smell of an annoying, so why the hell would you want to talk to them anyway, right? So why would I want to do the steps? So let's look at what it says for step 2, because step 2's got an interesting thing that it says, and I didn't even know that it said this, and I was stuck on step 2. And so on page 47, it says we need to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there's a power greater than myself? So he asked me the question, Sheldon, do you now believe? No, I don't believe. I don't believe. There's no God. I don't believe in God. There's no God. No, I don't believe. I get it. You don't believe. Really, I don't believe. There is no God. No God. Understand. Got it. You don't believe? I don't believe. I do not believe in God. That's okay. Are you even willing to believe that there might be a power greater than yourself? I mean, I get it that you don't believe. It's okay you don't believe. You don't believe in God. I get it. I agree. Don't know God. God does not exist. But are you willing to believe that maybe perhaps he might? I mean, that it's possible. That possibly, probably not. It's highly unlikely. I don't think so, no. Right? I mean, but even on the outside chance that he might, maybe. Perhaps. I mean, do you believe? No, I don't believe it. But are you willing that maybe? On a bad day, perhaps, that God might possibly exist. Maybe. Well, even an idiot like me can walk through a hole that big. I don't believe in God. No, I do not believe in God. No God, no God, no. But I'm willing to believe that maybe perhaps there might be a God. Maybe. Unlikely. Unlikely. If I had to bet on it, I'd bet against it. And I'm from Vegas. I'm a betting guy. As soon as a man can say that he either does believe, which by the way, I don't, or is even willing to believe, which I suppose I am, we emphatically ensure him he's on his way. Emphatically. That means like with excitement, like, whoo, you're done, buddy. Right? Step 2, in the bag, say the prayer. Say the goddamn prayer. Write the list. Write the list. Share the list. No one understands 6 and 7. Write the check. Write the check. Do it again. Do it again. Go help someone new. And you'll find God. And you'll find God. And it's that easy. All right. So I'm willing to believe that maybe perhaps there might be a God. Maybe. Unlikely. But I still don't really know why a guy like me would need God to begin with. I get that I'm in the trap I can't spring. I get it. I get that when I try to not drink, I get so uncomfortable that I drink again. I get that. And I get that when I start to drink, I can't control how much I'm going to drink. And I get that one way or the other, either through drinking too much, I'm going to show up here again, and I'm going to be on the stairs of AA saying, oh my God, I drink too much. Or I'm going to stay sober and I'm going to get so miserable that I'm going to come back to the stairs of AA and I'm going to say in a state of abstinence, I'm really, really sad. And I get that maybe perhaps God might exist. Again, but I'm a pretty smart guy. I'm a hard worker. You can look at my, if I take you down the history of my life, and I tell you very rarely can you find an alcoholic this isn't true for. There are exceptions to every rule, but it's very rare. Most of us, you take us down the journey of our life, and we can always find those bright spots, those moments when we were the national spokesperson for Kenwood Appliances, or like those grades that we got in school, or that job that we had, or that girl that we had, or that company that we had, or that promotion that we got. We're just great at going back through our lives and finding these bright spots that prove what Wilson said, I have arrived, our arrived moments. That I just know that if I can just get my hands on this drinking thing, I don't really need God. But when I really look at my life, and I show up at Alcoholics Anonymous for the umpteenth time, and I've been beaten and I've been backed into a corner, what is it really that I don't have power over? When we say lack of power is our dilemma, and I need to find a power by which I can live, what is it really that's happened to my life? Page 52. We were having trouble with personal relationships. You know the funniest thing is that Alcoholics Anonymous, we all say this. We all say we're people pleasers. Any people pleasers in the room? Right? There are some. When you first got here, and perhaps even today, how many people are pleased? I didn't have any pleased people in my life. In fact, when I wrote my full step, and we'll talk more about this tomorrow, but when I wrote my full step, I had everybody in my life that was either mad at me or I was mad at them. I mean, everybody. My full step was my mom, my dad, my brother, my previous employer, any girl I'd ever dated, any person I'd ever worked for, cousins, uncles, aunts, all the way down to anybody that had had any meaningless contact with me in my entire pathetic little life. I was 28 years old when I wrote my full step, and I have to tell you, the lunch lady from fourth grade was on there. The lunch lady. The woman that scooped the peas when I was 7 was on my full step. I'm pathetic. Right? I'm having trouble with personal relationships. I don't have any real good friendships. I'm useless at dealing with people. We can't control our emotional natures. I laugh inappropriately. I find things funny that aren't funny. You know, I tell you, I'm the guy, and I don't maybe hear this. I'm the guy on Facebook where a guy posts that his mom is sick. I post like. Right? I like your mom sick. Right? I'm just a whack, right? I don't know what's appropriate to find funny. I don't know what's appropriate to find sad. You liked something like that today, didn't you? You went like on something tragic on Facebook, right? But I'm a goof like that, right? I cry at the coffee commercial, right? When Maxwell House, when their fingers touch at the toaster, I start to weep, right? I mean, I'm inappropriately. I get afraid and I get angrier than I should get at situations. If she remembered my name, it must be love. I'm a prey to misery and depression. I'm a mope. I go home and if I start thinking about my life, I might have been having a good day and someone could say to me, how was your day? I'll stop thinking about it and they'll be depressed. I never, ever, ever spiral up into happiness. I always spiral down into misery. We couldn't make a living. I didn't understand that one for a while because I've always been a guy that's been able to earn money. And then somebody asked me a magic question. How much of it you still got?
None.
Have you ever been late on your rent?
Well, yeah.
But you earn 10 times your rent.
I know. I just can't seem to keep it till the end of the month.
I mean, some guys can't get a job. I can get a job, just can't keep a job. Some guys can't make any money. I can make money. It just falls out of my pocket buying things I don't need to impress people. That's the old cliche, right? By spending money I don't have to buy things I don't need to impress people I don't like. That's my, right? Because having money in your pocket doesn't mean you're making a living. It's spending that money on appropriate things and saving for retirement, apparently. Those are the signs that you're actually making. I had no idea. Those are the signs that you're making money, that you're making a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. Oh, my God. I hated me. I couldn't look me in the eye in the mirror. I'm the guy. How do you shave it? We learn how to do that. We shave without looking at our faces, right? Because we're afraid to catch ourselves in the eye. I think I'm a waste. And people don't like me, I think they're idiots. I have no value in this planet. Full of fear. Afraid of everything. We're unhappy. I want to kill myself. I'm beyond unhappy. I want to kill myself. Couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Man, I'm a producer of confusion, not happiness. I'm a guy that causes problems. I don't help nobody. I hurt everybody. I'm a disaster. When we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we could neither postpone nor evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition. Either God is everything or he's nothing. Either God is or he isn't. My good friend Bob Bazant says the greatest thing. He says when he came into AA, he didn't come in looking, running towards the light. He came in running away from the fire. And that's the way that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't come here looking for God. My life was such a disaster. I had nowhere else to go. Clint Hodges would talk about being on the cliff, on a cliff of your life, a cliff so steep and so sheer that you couldn't see the bottom. There was such a high cliff. There were clouds between below the cliff, between you and the floor. It's just this cliff. And your life is running at you. The warrants, the broken hearts, the angry parents, the ex-relationships, the disasters at work, the mess that you've made is charging at you. And if it gets you, you're done. But there's a cliff. There's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to go. And as your life's charging at you, there's a voice that comes up from the cliff. And it's the voice of that annoying old timer. You know, Mr. Are you ready yet? That guy. Have you had enough, Sheldon? That guy. Jump. God will catch you. No. But life's coming at me. I got nowhere to go. I can't go that way, and I can't go that way. Jump. I got no choice. I don't turn towards God. I turn away from the drama and the struggle and the problems of my life. I don't skip into the light. I run from the fire. And I jump off the cliff and I say to myself, I hope those idiots in AA are right. And that sums up my second step. My second step was that I got nowhere else to go, nothing else to do. And I don't really believe it's going to work. But I'm going to turn to God because I got no other choice. Bob.
I'm Bob Darrell. I'm an alcoholic. Are there any Al-Anons here? Oh, I knew it. I could feel you. I love Al-Anons. It's a group of people that has the potential to think about me as much as I do. So, people in AA say God. And I have this God resistance. And there's a whole lot of reasons behind that. I'm afraid of God. I don't think I'm going to measure up to God. I'm not going to be good enough. I'm too stained. I've done too many crappy things. I can't. I'm just too bad at being good and too good at being bad. I'm just not going to measure up to God. And God can't possibly warm up to me. He can warm up to a lot of people, I suppose, but he's not going to warm up to me. I know what I've done. I know what I've been. I know what I know. And Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't seem to care about any of that. You know, the Sheldon touched on it, that it's an action program. It doesn't matter that I don't believe in God. It doesn't matter that I come here and I'm a wannabe atheist. I'm not a real atheist. To be a real atheist, you have to be very religious about your atheism. I can't get that much angst about it. But what I am is a guy who's afraid of God. I'm a guy who's, because I fear that God's not going to accept me, I don't accept him first, and I'm that guy. But you tell me, just take the actions. The book says if we can do two things, if we can lay aside prejudice, that means can you get humble enough to know the most important thing you'll ever know is that you don't know? Can you just lay them aside? And we'll come and visit them later. Wilson says something in his story. He says, from now on, I will test everything against the newfound God consciousness within. Can you lay aside all your old ideas, all your preconceived notions, all your opinions, and be as like a child who knows nothing, and go through this process, this series of actions, and when you have the awakening, you come back and you can visit those things you've laid aside, as most of us do. I went back to the religion of my childhood after I worked the steps and got sober. I was sober a while. And I was amazed how much they had changed. They hadn't changed. My perception had changed. So can I lay them aside? Then the book says, and express even a willingness. Can I act like someone, not someone who believes, but can I act like someone who's at least willing to believe? And how would a guy like that act? Well, he would probably take actions he doesn't yet believe in. Because he's willing to express a willingness to believe. And so you guys had me do crazy things like pray. I told the guy, I said, you know, he wants me to get down on my knees, first of all, which I thought was a little humiliating. And I'm in a men's halfway house, so I have to go in the, I am not getting on my knees in the room with all the guys. So I have to go in the bathroom, lock the door, take the throw rug, throw it up against the crack under the door so nobody can peek under there and see me pray. And I get down on my knees and I feel like a hypocrite. I told him, I went back to him, I said, I feel like a hypocrite. I don't even believe in God. He said, you've been a hypocrite all your life. Just do it. Just do it. So I started to pray, and they told me, whenever you're disturbed, whenever you're having a tough time, stop and talk. Ask this power you don't believe in for help. What do you got to lose? And I thought, oh, okay. And I would do that. And things started happening in my life. From the moment I started to take the actions, it was almost as if there was massive shifts in the fabric of the universe that were accommodating my recovery. And which is, it's eerie if you're like me, because I've been a bad luck magnet for years. And now I'm having all these things happen that are just all in my favor. And it was remarkable. I started to come to believe the only way a guy like me can. I am incapable of believing because you tell me I need to. I am incapable of believing because it says in a book. But I can have an experience. And I started to have an experience with God. There's one of my favorite lines in the book. It says that God does not make hard terms with those who seek him. And I don't even believe in God, but I'm starting to show up and turn my consciousness towards him, even though I don't believe he exists. It's like in 100 yards, I'm going 2 or 3 yards and God's going the rest of the way. Right? And I'm taking these small little nothing actions against my will, really, against my better thinking, and the universe starts to change. And I start to have an experience with God. And so what happens is, well, we become to believe. I go to England. It's been about once a year now in the summertime. I go over there. If you've ever been to, I know Sheldon's been there. If you've ever been to the old part of London, the part that's called Westminster, that's down around from Trafalgar Square over through Hyde Park, the Abbey, the Parliament. It's the older section of London. And there's the street lights there are gas, not like we have electric. And if you can find some of the old poles, and I noticed the last time I was over there, they replaced almost all of them. But in the first time I went over there, they still had a lot of the older streetlight posts. And on the older ones, about eye level, there was this little box on the side of the pole, and it was welded shut and painted over. And many, many years ago, before they had the technology of the electric lighters and the things and the odd thing, the computerized things that turn the gas on, they'd had a guy who would walk up and down the streets of London at twilight, and he had a key, and he'd open that. That was a little door, and he'd open that little door, and he'd stick that key in, and he'd turn the gas on. And then he'd reach up with a long pole with a flame on it, and he'd light the street light, and then he would close the door, and he'd move on to the next light, and he'd go out and do the same thing, and he'd light it. And there was a team of people that would go up and down the streets, and they'd light the street lights. And at twilight, you could climb up to the top of the highest building in London, and no matter how hard you looked, you couldn't see the guy that was lighting the streetlights, but you could see where he'd been. And as a result of only taking these actions, I couldn't sit in a meeting at 2 years sober and actually see God, but I could see where God had been. And I started to come to believe and break through this God resistance, this God barrier by my experience. I sold myself by my reality that there's something here. And I couldn't even call it God for a while. I used that term out of Star Wars. I called it the Force, right? Because I had lingering prejudices from my childhood that eventually dissolved away. And so I started on this simple little method. But there's a big difference between having faith and what we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous. We talk about conscious contact. And if you've ever read William James or if even just in your own group, you'll see many, many alcoholics that have had spiritual experiences that have come to believe in God and then drank again. Because faith isn't enough. And that was really brought home to me I've had the experience of on several occasions briefly working with men of the cloth. And you would think a man of the cloth who prayed as much as they pray and read as many spiritual things as they read, you'd think they'd have a leg up on a bum like me. But two of those guys literally drank themselves to death. Because lack of faith was not their problem. Their problem was exactly what it says in the book, lack of power. And they could not lay aside all their prejudices and take actions that everybody else in AA took because they thought their prejudices were the right kind and they didn't have to do this, what appeared to be sophomoric spiritual actions, that they were up here. And so consequently, they never could get in the middle of this by doing what we do here. They could not humble themselves because they didn't know that they were egocentric and that they were the I know guys because everything they knew appeared to be good stuff. I mean, it was from their church. And maybe if they could have laid it aside and worked the steps and did what we did and had a spiritual awakening, maybe they would have revisited that stuff and said, well, that stuff was good. It's just I wasn't really in it. I was placating it intellectually, but I didn't have it in here. Because it wasn't experiential. And so you guys had me do this I broke through this thing. I came to believe in God. I took the third step. And I found myself experiencing the progression of the spiritual malady of alcoholism in my sobriety, going to 15 meetings a week and being a DCM and on two conference committees and sponsoring guys and doing H&I meetings. And I'll tell you something, you couldn't have been more active in Alcoholics Anonymous as I was, and I started to suffer from what I've come to understand as alcoholism. And I was very busy, and almost as if I was trying to outrun my disease. But I hadn't traversed from believing in God to having a conscious contact with God. And there's a world of difference between the two. One is of the mind. It's a belief. And the other one is experiential. And the difference between faith and conscious contact, when you get ready to leave here, if you drove here, you'll get in your car and you'll drive out on the street with complete faith that there are traffic laws and there are police to enforce them, and you'll have complete faith that those cops are there, and it may curtail your driving habits and within the limits of acceptability. And that's faith. You get a cop in your rear view mirror with his lights on, you've got conscious contact. And one is in your reality, and this is no kidding around. This is right here in your face. It's experiential. It's real. And the other one is just kind of the mind. And the problem with faith is there are times, and I probably had three or four times in 36 years when I needed, or if I hadn't have had a conscious experience with God, a knowing experience, not a faith experience, but a knowing experience, I'd probably be dead. When everything is falling apart. When you just found out, when your wife just moved in with your sponsee and took your daughter in there, and now you found out that she'd been cheating on you for the last year, or somebody very dear to you dies, or someone that you trusted for years that worked for you, and you found out they've been stealing, and they probably got you for $250,000, and you're really hurting, and you're upside down in the business because of that, and you don't know what to do, and the fear is on you, and the emotions are putting the screws to you. If you don't have an experience with God that you can hold on to, you're in trouble. Faith isn't enough. Father Martin said it very well one time. And faith is of the mind. And he said that when emotion and intellect are in conflict with each other, the emotion always wins. See, my emotions are more persistent and they will grind away my faith. But they can't grind away an actual experience. Because I've tasted God. I have had the experience with God. I've felt His presence. And I may not feel it at the moment. I'm in trouble, but I've been there. And I know it's possible to get back to that. I know it's there. And so what happens to me is I have to... When I break through the God barrier and I come to believe, it kind of feels to God-resistant, wannabe atheist, agnostic people of my type, it feels like you've arrived. A lot of people leave Alcoholics Anonymous at this point and go off on some church as if they've arrived. If you've arrived anywhere at all with step two, you've arrived at the beginning of the road. There's a long way to go from here into conscious contact. And on page 55, it is a very, very clear view of what the problem is and what the solution is. Chuck Chamberlain was my grand sponsor. He was a brilliant man. And Chuck used to say there's one problem and it contains all problems. And that is separation. I'm blocked from God. when I'm blocked from other people. The problem is, it's all initiated by the bondage of self. See, I got too much of me between me and you, and I got too much of me between me and God. And I'm blocked. And that's exactly what the book says. It first thing it says on page 55 in the second paragraph, it talks about what you'll hear old-timers talk about, where you're going to find God. It says, deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. Deep down in me? I can't get my head around that. How could something so good and so powerful be deep inside something I know to be so weak, pathetic, and bad? God's deep in me, not in me. And yet I hear the old times, I used to hear Chamberlain talk about God's not lost in pointing a guy's chest. He's right in there. He's right in there. I remember listening to a woman talking about how she liked to be alone in silence and commune with God. And the way she said it was so enticing. I thought, yeah, I'm going to go home. No TV, no. I'm just going to be quiet and commune with God. I did that, and about 30 seconds later, I thought I was having a panic attack. I had to turn the television on. Because when it got quiet out here, it got noisy in here. Well, why is that? Well, the book says it is deep down within me, but it says it might be obscured, might be blocked by three things. By calamity. The clamor. It's always there, talks to you, doesn't it? It just says stuff to you. It never goes away. It's the chatter. So the Buddhists call it the monkey mind. It's the voice of the ego. It's the voice of self. It's always chattering. It's trying to scare you. It's spooking you. It wakes you up in the morning telling you the terrible things that could possibly happen today. It's constantly presenting you with unsolved problems that haven't occurred yet to occupy your attention, to keep you at the driver's seat. It's a problem-seeking missile, and it's always looking, and it's chattering at you. It's noisy. If God really was inside you and you haven't worked the steps, you're like me, even if you had a megaphone, I'm not going to hear him over the clamoring in my head. If you were to read the Old Testament in the original Hebrew, and you were to read Genesis when it talks about the Garden of Eden, and it get to the point where Adam and Eve are introduced to the serpent in the garden, if you were to literally translate the word they used in the Hebrew into the English, it was not the word that they used for serpent. It was the word they used to describe the sound the serpent made. It was the hiss. It's always there. It's always talking to you. It just never goes away. It's telling you what's wrong with the people around you. It's saying things to you like, why has he got his hand next to his head? It's just talking to you. It just always chatters. It distracts you from your very life as your life slips by, and it owns you. And it's got your attention. So I'm blocked from God by the clamor of the calamity in my own head, the way this spooks me and scares me. The second thing is pomp. And pomp's a good word for ego. I'm so full of myself and what I'm right about and my perceptions. And most of us get to Alcoholics Anonymous, we fit the old adage, you can always tell an alcoholic, you just can't tell them much. I'm dying, but smarter than everybody. We're the alcoholic, I heard this years ago, we're the only people that can lay in the gutter and look down on the rest of society. And then the third thing that's blocking me, obscuring me from God, the God within me, is the worship of other things. I had no clarity on that and could not see that until I was a little over a year sober, and I was ending my first sober relationship. And I've sponsored a lot of guys over the years, and I've come to the conclusion from my own experience and from theirs, that there's not a person on the planet more self-obsessed than an alcoholic ending a relationship. I mean, you can go up to a guy like that and say, I just came from the doctor, I have terminal cancer and 2 weeks to live, and he'll say, do you know what else she said? You know, it just gets right here. You can't, I mean, it consumes you. And it's on me, man. And I'm whacked, man. I am just nuts. And I don't know what to do. So I go to a meeting thinking maybe somebody will say something there. Well, I get in the meeting, and because she's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and not in the meeting, I don't hear anything in the meeting. I'm in my head having conversations with her. You know, if I see her, she'll say this, and I'll say that, and she'll say this, and I'll hit her with that, and she'll be properly ashamed of herself and want me back. You know, I'm just running that stuff in the meeting. And because she's a member of AA and not in that particular meeting, there's a spring in the back of my neck connected to the door. Every time the meeting room door opens, I go, oh, no, not her. Oh, not her. Oh, not her. Right? So by the end of the meeting, if God had been trying to talk to me through the people in AA, I ain't getting none of it because I'm just consumed with this thing. And I'm dying here. I feel like someone's cut off the oxygen to my soul. I'm so disconnected and so locked up in these emotions that are horrid and these crazy thoughts I can't shut off. I'm dying. And I went out to coffee with an old timer from out of town. And because he was a visitor, I knew that I could get him to listen to me talk about this relationship. Nobody else, everybody else is tired of me talking about it. So I get him hostage in this booth in a restaurant, and I'm telling about this relationship for 20 or 30 minutes till his eyes have glazed over. And he's a very nice guy, man. He's just listening, nodding his head. And when I ran out of gas, he said something to me that blew my mind. He says, kid, have you ever thought about the first commandment? The minute he said that, I had this prejudice, you know. I'm not really into that. I'm just into A. And he starts laughing. He says, yeah. He says, you and I are very much alike. Guys like us have a hard time getting past the thou shalt not in the Ten Commandments. He said, but it's my experience that they were originally conceived as statements of spiritual cause and effect. And in the, as they were translated from one language to another, they developed an authoritarian spin by some well-meaning people. And as they are in the English today, the first commandment is, I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt not put false gods before me. And he said, I know something for sure, that God loves you and he loves me no matter what. That there's nothing you can do to make God not love you. You can put anything you want between you and God still loves you. The problem is when you do that, you just put something between you and God. You just block the light. He said, if you want to know what you worship, it doesn't mean to bow down to something. To worship something is to obsessively turn your consciousness towards something. He said, it's easy to know what you worship. At the end of your day, make a pie graph of everything you've been thinking about. And the thing that would dominate the pie graph would obviously be the thing you're obsessively turning your consciousness towards. When he said that, I'm a visual guy. I could picture it in my mind, this pie graph. A little bit of AA, a little bit of work, and almost the whole pie graph was this relationship. And I knew why I was in such desolation. I had taken this, in the big picture, nothing thing. And I put it between me and you and me and God and me and life itself. And I was alone and stuck on the other side of the separation I was using it to create between me and life. And why would I do that? And what do you do that with? We do it usually with things that contain within them an illusion of power. Because lack of power, it truly is my dilemma. But a relationship has with it an illusion of power. If you had the right person loving you the right way, then surely then you will have had the power to validate yourself as a person. You will have found the power to ward off all those squirmy little vacant feelings of loneliness. You will have the power, you will have found the power to be connected. You will surely have rested satisfaction and happiness out of this world by managing well. And we do it with money. Money gives an illusion of power, or prestige at a job, or position, status. That if I made enough money, well, how much is enough money? Just enough so you don't need God. You know how much that is? I'll tell you. It's $5 more than you're ever going to make. And I know, because I rode that horse up the hill. And as I rode it up the hill, I started with, when I first got sober, $3 and something an hour was my wage, because I was minimum wage. And as I went up the hill, I would be, what, $5? I'd be there. You get $5. No, not $5. It's 12. I know it's 12. You get 12. No, it ain't 12. It's 20. You get 20. No, it ain't 20. It's 100,000 a year. You get 100. No, it's more. It's you can't, that's a dog you can't feed full. You can't feed full. But why would I be obsessed with something like that? Because of the delusion that if I had enough money, I would be problem free and I'd be secure and I'd be happiness. When in actuality, without God in my life, without trusting in God, more money is more anxiety. Mm-hmm. It's more crap to worry about. It's more stuff you have to protect. It's more things you can lose. Did you ever look on the dollar bill? You know what it says on there? It doesn't say, in money we trust. It says, in God we trust. That's the problem. Is that I'm looking for power where there is no power. And that's not that a relationship isn't great. That's not that money isn't convenient at times. But it makes a terrible source of security and sustenance. It's a terrible reliance. Because there is one, there is no power there, but there is one who has all power. And that God is, and that power, that one is God. May you find him in a place that you've probably never visited, have you now? You're not a now person. You're a thinker. I know, I'm a thinker. Thinkers don't really visit now. We do drive-bys occasionally. And then withdraw back up to analyze what it was like when we were in the now. It's like, you know, just a little drive-by and whoop, here again, all right. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that? All right, okay. So if I can do those things, I'm going to tell you, the promise is that if I can uncover, discover, and discard the things that are blocking me from God, if I can reduce myself enough, I start to have an experience with God. I'm going to take about 5 minutes and tell you a little story. We're running over, but this is kind of a setup for what we're going to do tomorrow. You know, I got sober in a treatment center in 1978. I had a counselor in there who was also a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a woman named Judy Harrison. She was also a member of a group called the Floating Big Book Group, even though she didn't go every week. She went intermittently. And I was 3 months sober. And I ran into her at a meeting of the Floating Big Book, and she wanted to talk to me. Now, here's a woman who knew pretty much everything about me. She did my history, and I mean, she, you know how they do in treatment centers. She knew all the treatment centers I was in, all the times I'd been around Alcoholics Anonymous, all the therapy. She knew I worked in the field. She knew all that stuff. And she comes up to me, I'm 3 months sober, and she says to me, she's looking at me kind of with an odd look. She says, Bob, what happened to you? And I don't know what she means. I said, Judy, what do you mean? She says, what happened to you? Judy, I don't know what you mean. She says, listen, you've been around AA for a long time, right? Yeah. She said, I hear you got Dick Tucson as a sponsor and you're calling him regular. I said, yeah, I do. And she said, he's a good man. She said, every time I'm leaving the detox, it seems like you're one of the guys bringing the meetings in there. And I said, yeah, I go several times a week. She said, I heard you signed up for the new meeting at the Gene prison they're going to start. I said, yeah, I did. I didn't really want to go there because I didn't think I had enough tattoos, but I thought, okay. She said, I hear you're secretary of a meeting. And I was. I said, I am, but I'm not supposed to be. I'm only 3 months sober. They voted me in anyway. She said, I hear you're praying. Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I don't know if I believe it. I just was embarrassed to even talk about that. Yeah, I'm going through the motions. And then she said, what happened to you? You never did all that stuff before. And that blew my mind. Because I thought, my God, what happened to me? Because my last run was not the worst one. I had some earlier years before. If horror was going to snap you into AA, I had some other runs that should have done it. This was not the worst one. But for some reason, it was the one I didn't understand what had happened to me. And when you come off the streets in Alcoholics Anonymous and you extend yourself to receive help here and you let the people in AA know you're in AA and you want help, I'm telling you, they're all over it. If you don't want help and your body language says, leave me alone, for the most part, we leave you alone. There's always one person in a group somewhere that's off their meds that won't leave you alone. But for the most part, they'll leave you alone. We respect it. We respect your right to think we're full of crap. I mean, because we all at one time thought you were full of crap. I mean, so we respect that. But if you ask for help and you show up like you want it, man, we're all over it. Because we live to do that. That's our primary number one purpose. And I had help coming at me, and I had nothing. I was off the streets. People would give me rides from the halfway house to meetings. They'd give me cigarettes. This guy Tim, who was a dice dealer down at Aladdin, he brought me out to a parking lot outside a meeting, and he said, I need your help. You can do me a favor. My wife wants me to get rid of all this stuff. Could you take it off my hands? And he opens his trunk. And there's like a cashmere sport coat and a couple, I mean, there's some nice stuff, slacks and shirts, all from the dry cleaners, really nice stuff. And he's asking me to help him by taking it off his hands because he knew that if he would have said to me, you need help, that my ego would have went like this. He knew how to give love to someone who can't really receive it. And he had a box of books in there, and they were novels and things, books he'd already read, and he'd heard that I like to read, and I do. I read probably 2 books a week to this day. And these were interesting books, not recovery stuff, not psychology, not spiritual, just interesting novels. And I said, yeah, man, there's some science fiction, some mysteries in there. Yeah, I'm in, man. And I gave him those books, and I started reading one of the books. And I got to a point in that book where I read about something that blew my mind, and all of a sudden I understood exactly what had happened to me. And in this novel, there was a part of the book where these scientists were interested in the human brain. And so they were doing experiments on the brain, and they discovered this part of the brain that it had a Latin name, but they called it the pleasure center. It's where you experience the euphoria from alcohol and drugs, where you get high. So they took these laboratory rats and they put 2 tiny wire filaments into the pleasure center of the rat's brain, and then they would pass a mild electric stimulus through those wires and the rat would get high. So what they did is they hooked up the juice to a pedal in the rat's cage, and the rat would learn he could hit the pedal and get high. So the rat would just lay on the pedal. I mean, he don't sleep, he don't eat, he don't... You could bring opposite sex rats in there and heat, and he just, not now, baby, I'm partying. And he'd hit that pedal until he died. Usually, his heart would seize up from dehydration and exhaustion. Well, after a few rats died, the scientists realized, oh, these rats are dying. And they started putting these monitors on them to see when they were in danger. And then when a rat would get, he hit the pedal so long that he's in danger of dying, they'd turn the juice off. Now that poor rat hits that pedal, only nothing happens. And he hits it again and nothing happens, and again and again and again. And after countless futile attempts to turn the juice back on, the rat finally gets it once and for all that this is over. And instead of being able to go back to being a rat, he curls up in a ball and lays on the floor of the cage to die. Because without the juice, what's the point? In 1978, I'm that rat. I didn't come here, get hit. My bottom did not involve consequences. My bottom involved a hopeless condition of mind and body where there's no friendly direction and there's no relief anywhere. Alcoholism had turned the juice off, and I tried for years to turn it back on, and I finally knew the bitter, bitter truth that it was over. And I couldn't live without it. And, I tell you, all these years later, I'm convinced that Alcoholics Anonymous is not designed to get you to quit drinking. You want to quit drinking, punch a cop. You're going to quit for a little while. Alcoholics Anonymous is designed to do one thing and one thing only. That's turn the juice back on. The actions of Alcoholics Anonymous are designed to create the spiritual awakening that is very similar to the awakening that happened when alcohol worked and it lit you up. And it lit you up. You know, and I didn't know that. And you could, if you would have tried to, when I was new, if you would have tried to tell me that the steps and the actions of service and all the things we do here were going to do that, I wouldn't have believed you. But I believed in my own hopelessness enough to take your actions. See, I didn't really want a spiritual way of life. I didn't want that. It seemed stupid and pathetic to me. I don't want that. I don't even really want to be sober. I just want to stop suffering. If you'd given me one wish, a genie would have popped out of a bottle and gave me one wish, it wouldn't have been sobriety. I think if I could have been honest with that genie, I'd have said, please, let me get high like I got high when I was 18 years old. Put me back with those guys I ran around with. Put me back to that feeling of freedom. If you give me 5 years feeling like that, I'll let you kill me at the end of those 5 years, but give me those 5 years. Instead, I get a big book and a sponsor and a home group and a bunch of commitments. And years later, I found out that I got exactly what I would have wished for. It just came in a different form. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you in the morning. We have Money House.